Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Gail Sylvia, host of SylviaGlobal.com. Thank you for joining me today. My special guest is Daniel Pilla, and Daniel is a tax litigation consultant and author, an expert on winning battles with the IRS. Dan, are you with us?
I'm here, Gail. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm well, thank you. Please pronounce your last name for me so I get it correct.
Sure, it's Pilla.
Pilla, and do you prefer Dan or Daniel?
Yeah, Dan.
Okay, Dan. Thank you for joining us. I understand that you're one of the most sought-after tax authorities in the nation and that you appear regularly on radio and national TV. Actually, I saw you on a television broadcast, and that you also do quite a bit of writing for, you've appeared in Money Magazine, Family Circle, Business and Finance, and you have testified to both congressional and Senate committees, as well as congressional policy commissions. But your real day-to-day work seems to lie in helping the average person understand how they can interact with and not be intimidated by the IRS. Is this correct?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. My day-to-day work, Gail, is based on helping folks that have current problems with the Internal Revenue Service. About 70% of the work that I do is collection defense, so I help people that have tax debts that they owe and can't pay. So we help folks cope with wage levies, bank levies, tax liens, that sort of thing. And then the rest of the work that I do, the balance of the work that I do is a lot of audit defense and audit appeals where folks are going through tax audits and the IRS is trying to determine, you know, through the tax audit process that they owe more money. And I help folks with those challenges as well by representing them in the appeals process and through the United States Tax Court.
Now, so that our listeners understand, this is part one of a two-part conversation that you and I will be having. The first part today is to introduce them to tax amnesty, how to get it, what it is, situations and steps that they can get advice from, tips on from you about how to maneuver or where to start the process of maneuvering to resolve their problems with the Internal Revenue Service. And then the second conversation for part two, we'll come back and talk about some of the more sophisticated resources and examples that evolve around offshore investments and what it means to have wealth and funds offshore in dealing with the IRS. So talk to us about tax amnesty. What is it? How does it work? And what are the steps that listeners can take to, to gain tax amnesty?
Sure. Well, tax amnesty is a phrase it's actually the title of my book, is How to Get Tax Amnesty. And tax amnesty is the phrase I use to describe the process of negotiating with the Internal Revenue Service to reduce or eliminate a tax debt that you might owe. There's all kinds of different strategies that are available for dealing with the Internal Revenue Service when you have a tax debt. That could involve, for example, an installment agreement. The IRS has, over the last 3 years in general, and really over the last 3 months in particular, Gail, they have greatly simplified the processes that are utilized to obtain an installment agreement that's reasonable based on how much you owe. The other element of, there's a lot of different elements of this. Another one of the key elements that I use in my strategies of helping folks solve these problems is the penalty abatement process. You know, I've heard people tell me 1,000 times, I can pay my taxes. It's the penalties and the interest that are killing me. What the IRS doesn't tell people, Gail, is that every single tax provision of the, or every single penalty provision of the tax code has what's called a good faith or reasonable cause provision. And what it means very simply is if you acted in good faith and based on a reasonable cause for your actions, if you didn't deliberately disregard IRS rules and regulations, the penalties don't apply. In that situation where you don't deliberately disregard rules and regulations, you can make a request to the IRS to cancel the penalty. And if you can show this good faith reasonable cause element that I'm talking about, they will cancel the penalties, and that will cancel interest on the penalties, and that reduces the bill quite substantially. In many cases, it cuts it down to the point where a person can quite easily, quite readily pay it off and be done with it. And so that's an example. Another example is where we typically use the phrase amnesty is in the process known as the offer and compromise. The offer and compromise is a strategy the IRS uses that allows taxpayers to negotiate their debt for a settlement based on less than they owe. Let me give you an example. Suppose you owe the IRS $50,000 in taxes and there's no possible way you can pay that. Let's say that the maximum of your ability to pay is, pick a number, let's say it's 20 grand. Well, if the IRS accepts $20,000 in place of the 50 or instead of 50, you've just settled your case for 40 cents on the dollar. Now, an individual's capacity to settle his case depends on the ability to pay. We settle these things, the settlement numbers are all over the lot, and this is where it gets dangerous when we talk about this in general terms, because it's not a situation where there's an automatic settlement percentage. You can't say it's going to be 10 cents on the dollar or 5 cents on the dollar or even 30 cents on the dollar. It just depends entirely on an individual's capacity to pay, and the settlement numbers range widely based on that.
This is really intriguing, because if these calculations and this information is a part of the rights of a citizen, how does the average person access or learn about these tips and this insight, gain this insight?
Well, and that's the $6 million question is, why doesn't everybody know about this? And the answer is, for the most part, the IRS doesn't talk about this stuff. Let's talk about the offer and compromise, for example. The IRS will make it clear to somebody, if you just pick up the phone and call the IRS and say, I can't pay my debt, is there something I can do? You will get somebody in the IRS to tell you, well, yeah, you can do an offer and compromise. If you can't pay the debt, go ahead and make an offer. Okay, so that all sounds well and good. You just, quote-unquote, make an offer. But how do you negotiate the offer? That's the problem, because the IRS wants the money, Gail. Their job is to get the money, and they just don't automatically accept these things. You have to go through what's called an offer investigation process, which involves the submission of a financial statement and supporting documents to prove your expenses and so on, and that you got to prove your income and establish to the satisfaction of the IRS that you're not making more money than than you claim to be making, and so all of these things have to be handled through the offer negotiation process, and this is where people fall down. Anyone can fill out the form and submit it to the IRS. That's not rocket science at all. But where it gets tricky is negotiating the points of the fine points of the investigative process. In my book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, in my Tax Amnesty Supplement, I take the reader step by step by step through this process. I show you exactly what you have to prove. And this is very important, Gail, and this is another area where people fall down, where they get into trouble. When you're dealing with the Internal Revenue Service, the burden of proof is always on the taxpayer. The IRS doesn't have to prove that you did it wrong. You have to prove you did it right. Or in the case of an offer and compromise, they don't have to prove that you don't qualify. You have to prove that you do qualify. And so that burden of proof is on you, and the obligation to come up with that proof is your responsibility. It's an affirmative duty on your part. And what I do is I show you exactly what you have to do to meet that initial burden of proof, and then I show you the key areas where the IRS will challenge you in your offer situation, and then I show you exactly how to overcome those challenges so that you've got every reasonable chance of getting your offer accepted.
Back up for a moment and share with the listeners your background and how you became, why this area of practice and litigation became so important to you.
Sure, yeah. I got started, Sylvia, I've been doing this over 30 years now, and I got started in the mid-1970s. Actually, I got started in the late 1970s as a result of problems my father had with the IRS in the early 1970s. He had a business here in our hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota, got behind on his employees withholding taxes, and he had, you know, a couple of employees at the time and got behind on the payroll taxes, which is a very, very common problem for small businesses that run into financial trouble. They get the, you know, they get behind on those employment taxes, you know, pretty quickly, and that stuff piles up. And the IRS is very serious about collecting the employment taxes. Well, and that's what happened to my dad's situation. So in 1974, Gail, what they did is they padlocked the doors on my father's business. They auctioned the equipment off for a couple of cents on the dollar, and then later on, several years later, they turned their attention to the family home, and they tried to seize and sell it for the back tax liability, and that's how I got started. That's how I got involved. I got involved trying to help my family solve that problem, and I was able to do that, and I've been working in this area ever since.
Let me ask you a couple questions related to that scenario, because over the past couple of years, especially since 2009 and the economic tsunami that hit the entire nation and affected many small business owners, and a lot of our listeners are small business, are business owners of various ranges of business owners, you know, have gotten behind on taxes and payroll taxes. How did your father and your family emotionally survive that? Because by the time a business owner gets to you, there's so much emotional stress that has evolved, you know, in that process that they're pretty beaten down.
You know what? I'll tell you what, Gail, I don't mean to interrupt you, but that is one of the biggest problems that people have dealing with the IRS is the emotional stress, the fear, the uncertainty. You know, I had a meeting in my office this morning with a couple of clients that we're working through a tax court case on right now, and we've negotiated a settlement that's reasonable under the circumstances, but you know, not every case is the best case scenario, and this one is not the best case scenario, and they're going to owe some money, and they know it, and it becomes a very, very traumatic situation for these folks, and it is not unusual. I'll tell you what, just going back to my father's situation, my father's case was the worst case scenario, and I'll tell you why. As I said, he had his business seized in 1974, and then in 1978, 79, they tried to seize and they auctioned the equipment off for a couple cents on the dollar, so he was out of business. But what happened, Sylvia, is after they put the padlocks on the doors, he went back inside the building. All right, he violated the quote unquote no trespassing signs that were pasted on the door, and the IRS arrested him when he was inside the building. And then they later charged him with the federal crime of rescuing seized property. So he was then charged with a crime. In about 1976 or so, 77, right in there, the dates are getting a little fuzzy for me, he ended up in jail as a result of that. So he did about 9 months in a federal prison here in Minnesota because of being convicted of that crime of rescuing seized property. All right, so now the next thing is, while he was in jail is when they tried to seize our family home, which is why I got involved in the first place. If he were not in jail, I would never have been involved in this thing because, you know, he was quote-unquote handling it. Well, I came home from wherever I was one day. I'd graduated from high school by this point. But I came home one day, and my mom is sitting at the kitchen table, and she's holding an envelope from the IRS, and she hands it to me, and she says, you know, what do you make of this? So I read it. And I see, and I tell her that it looks like they're going to try to seize the house. And she says, well, what do we do? Of course, I had no idea what to do. But what I did is I went over to the local law library. We lived on the edge of downtown St. Paul. There's a law school there in town. I went over to the law library. I start fumbling around in the Internal Revenue Code, not even knowing what I was looking for, and literally stumbled onto a section of the tax code that deals with taxpayers' rights issues and limits the power of the IRS, and I start reading. I don't get 6 pages into this code section, and I discover that the IRS is proceeding illegally to seize this property. So I did what any 18-year-old would do under the circumstances. I sued the IRS. Quite literally, I pasted together a Mickey Mouse lawsuit using the forms and procedures that I found in the library when I was just a process of reading through it, and I found myself in a courtroom in Minneapolis one day in about 1979, right in there. And the IRS flew an attorney in from Washington, D.C. to have my lawsuit thrown out. And I remember saying to the judge, Judge, you know, here's what the law says. It's very simple. This is what the IRS is doing. It's not consistent with the law. You know, they should be stopped. And I sat down, and my argument was about that long and about that polished. There just wasn't anything to it. And the attorney from Washington stands up, and he starts blathering on about code sections this and case law that, and I didn't know what this guy was talking about. But when he was all finished, the judge looked at him and pointed at me and said, he's right, and he slammed the gavel. So that was it. I thought to myself, this is easy. And so that's how I got started. But it is, in answer to your question, it's a very, very traumatic time in people's lives. It leads to marital failures. It leads to family strife, business failures, and in some cases, people take their lives over the stress that this causes. And that's why it's so important for people to understand that these problems are not hopeless. And the solutions are available, and there are things you can do to keep this under control, to keep from happening to you what happened to my father. What happened to my father never has to happen to another American if you understand what your rights are and how to deal with this stuff.
Are not an attorney by law, by professional.
Say that again,
correct?
Please, Gail.
Are you a practicing attorney? Are you a CPA?
I am an enrolled agent with the Internal Revenue Service. Let me tell you both functions here. I'm enrolled to practice before the IRS, and I'm licensed to practice in front of the United States Tax Court. So I have a very limited practice dealing strictly with the Internal Revenue Service at the administrative level. As an enrolled agent, I can practice before the IRS at the administrative level, represent people in all kinds of IRS disputes at the administrative level. And as a tax court practitioner, I'm licensed to practice in the United States Tax Court, which is the federal court that's set up to exclusively hear tax cases. And I can represent people fully and completely in the United States Tax Court.
So it would be a false assumption for a business owner or a listener here in this case to assume that because they have a CPA or, their accountant filing their taxes and taking care of their, their business bookkeeping, that they're knowledgeable in this same arena to the same extent that you're describing your area of expertise.
Yeah, that is very true, Gail, and the reason is for this. The vast number of CPAs that are out there are highly qualified to handle the tax preparation and tax planning elements of dealing with the Internal Revenue Service. CPAs know, again, there are exceptions to this rule naturally, but as a general rule, the profession is all about tax law compliance, filing the forms correctly, filing the forms on time, accounting for the income properly, accounting for the deductions properly, and accountants are well suited to do all of that, and accountants, CPAs are well suited to do the tax planning type things that small businesses need to be able to look forward in their financial lives and to make the necessary plans to deal with the financial realities that businesses face. But that's tax planning and tax preparation is one thing. And tax litigation is something completely different. And most accountants, not all of them, but most CPAs and very few enrolled agents have any background in tax litigation, whereas that's all I do. On the other hand, I'm not suited to prepare tax returns or do tax planning.
Right. Back to your family story, because it really speaks to the heart of what a lot of Americans are experiencing. What advice do you give them, and at what stage of the process do you give them some wisdom or knowledge to prevent from happening to them what your dad experienced?
Well, the thing about my father and the thing that I see with so many of my clients, and let's just talk generally here, is people don't know how to deal with the problems on the front end. They get afraid of the IRS for good reason. They're intimidated by the whole process for good reason. And what that leads to is, in many cases, inaction. And that was my father's problem. That is the problem of most of the clients that I deal with that come to me by the time the situation has gone from bad to worse. I liken myself to a trauma surgeon in the ER room. People don't go to the ER room, to have their blood pressure checked. They go to the ER room when they've been in a car crash and they're bleeding to death. That's when they end up in the ER. And so when my clients come to me, that's kind of the financial position that they're in. But they got that way because they ignored or disregarded some IRS correspondents on the front end, you know, as I say, they were afraid of the process, intimidated by the process. They didn't know what to do. When people are afraid, Gail, and they're intimidated and they're ignorant, a lot of times they do nothing. And so by doing nothing, what happens is you allow some of your important rights to evaporate. A lot of the rights you have as a taxpayer are time sensitive. You have to do, you know, X action within so many days. You got to do Y action within so many days. And if you don't do that, you lose your right to take that action to challenge the IRS. And that limits, it doesn't eliminate, but it limits your capacity to deal with them on the other end. Now, there's almost always a way to work around that, but that's what happens, is it becomes a workaround that you can accomplish when you really know the ins and outs of the IRS. But if you don't know the ins and outs, you don't know the workarounds, and now it really gets bad.
How do people rebound from this? What are some of the success stories that you can share so that there is hope and optimism in the midst of despair?
Well, getting back to this offer and compromise situation for an example. I mean, I've just wrapped up three offers and compromise here in the last 2 weeks for clients, and one guy had a situation where he had about a $319,000, almost $320,000 tax liability, Gail, that arose because of some. This is a bizarre story, and I don't need to get into all the details of his situation, but basically he made a lot of money in some stock trades that ended up getting stolen from him by a securities broker who it's a long story, but the bottom line is he lost all the money that he made, but he had all these paper gains, and the losses wouldn't offset the gains. And again, there's technical reasons for this we don't need to get into, but the bottom line is he ended up owing $320,000 to the IRS. And this guy was just, you know, he's just a little guy, had no capacity to pay that money. And we just negotiated an offer and compromise for him for about $6,100. You know, so that, I mean, that's a tremendous success story in my mind. What is more?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you say from $320,000 to
$6,100? Yeah, that's what I said. Yep, $320,000.
I want to make sure I understood you correctly.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You understood correctly. Now, that is uncommon, all right? The more common situation is another offer and compromise I worked for a client that we got resolved in the last 2 weeks. She was a real estate agent here in the Twin Cities area, was beaten down tremendously in the real estate market, had some back tax liabilities that she accrued for a couple of 3-4 years, and she owed the IRS about $40,000. Now, you know, keep in mind that whenever you give a tax liability number, about half the number is the tax, and the other half the number is the penalties and interest. You know, so that's one thing to keep in mind. But we settled her case for about $3,000. So that's not quite as radical as the first example I gave you, but it's an example. And other common scenarios, Gail, involve situations where somebody owes, you know, $15,000 or $20,000. It's not a great deal of money. It's a lot of money. It's a heck of a lot of money. I'm not saying it isn't. But those folks can pay the tax over time, but that's what they need is time. And so in those situations, we're you know, very successful at negotiating reasonable installment agreements that people can pay the tax over time under reasonable terms and conditions that don't crush them in the process.
So there are options available, and people don't always end up in jail and don't need to be losing sleep as long as they take action and know the rules of engagement.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're exactly right, Gail. And let's talk about this going to jail thing. I know I brought it up with my father, but as I said, it was the worst case scenario. The overwhelming majority of people that have tax problems need to know two things. Number one, they all think they're going to jail. Anytime you talk to a person with a tax problem, the first question out of their mouth is, am I going to jail? All right, they need to know that that as a practical matter, the answer is no. The fact is, Gail, you got a better chance of being eaten by a shark than you do of going to jail for a tax crime. And the reason is this, and this is it's a little bit counterintuitive, because as I said, everybody thinks you go to jail for tax issues. You go to jail for tax crimes. You don't go to jail for tax debts. And there's a difference. If you deliberately cheated on your tax return, if you lied to the IRS on your return, if you evaded the tax, if you gave a false statement on your return, if you reported bogus deductions or hid your income, then there is a chance that you might go to jail for that if the IRS can prove that you deliberately intended to break the law. In a criminal case, the IRS has the burden of proof. But the vast majority, overwhelming majority of American people don't do that, Gail. They don't cheat on their taxes. The overwhelming majority of people do the level best they can to comply with a very complicated tax code, and they do their best to pay their taxes in full on time, in full and on time. But in many cases, people just don't have the money to do that. In many cases, people have to make the very difficult choice of paying their taxes or feeding their families. And when somebody's in the position where they have to make that choice, and they choose to feed their family and not pay the taxes, that doesn't make them a criminal. It makes them broke, but it doesn't make them a criminal. And you don't go to jail for being broke. So that's the thing you need to understand. The second thing is, again, just because you have this debt doesn't mean that the IRS isn't going to work with you. The IRS will work with honest taxpayers who are down on their luck, who through no fault of their own don't have the capacity to pay, if you play ball with them. And what I mean by that is you got to do a couple of things to get yourself back in the game. Number one is you got to make sure that you're current with your tax return filings. A lot of people that have tax problems have gotten delinquent on their tax returns. They've stopped filing their returns for 2, 3, 4 years or more. You got to get current with the tax return filings. For right now, we're talking about tax year 2011. That's the return that's due now. That's the one that needs to be filed on. Of course, it's not on time anymore, but you need to get it filed as quickly as you can. The second thing you need to do is get current with your estimated tax payments for the tax year that we're in. The tax year that we're in right now, Gail, is 2012. That's the year that you're earning money in right now, and you have an obligation to pay your taxes as the income is earned. So if you do those two things, you get current with your 2011 tax return filing and 2012 estimated tax payments, either through wage withholding or as a self-employed person through your estimated payments, then the IRS will play ball with you.
And a lot of people filed extensions, and you've made reference to, in other interviews, Form 1127 and the secret weapon. When someone has filed an extension on their tax, returns or for tax filing, is this an opportunity for them to get situations on the right path?
Well, yeah. The form. Let me explain Form 1127. Form 1127 is an application for an extension of time to pay the taxes. Now, you use the term extension. When you use the term extension, people always think of the extension of time to file the return. Everybody knows about that. You can file that extension of time in April when your tax return is due, and it gets you 6 additional months to file your return, and everybody knows about that. And most of your listeners have probably used that in the past. That extension of time to file the return does not give you more time to pay the tax. The tax is still due on April 15th. And even if the tax return can't be finished, you have to make a good faith estimate, which, flies in the face of logic, but nevertheless, it's the rule. You have to make a good faith estimate of what your tax liability is, and you have to pay that tax by April 15th. So a lot of people say, well, Dan, I don't need more time to file my return. I have my tax return finished. It's laying on the desk here in front of me. I can't pay by the due date, which this year was April 17th. So how does a filing extension help me? Well, the answer is the filing extension doesn't help you. What you need is a payment extension, the Form 1127. Now, the bad news, Gail, is that the time for filing that request for extension time to pay the tax is gone. That was April 17th of this year, and if you didn't file it by then, it's too late to file it now. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't get time to pay the tax. You can use Plan B. Plan B is Form 9465. It's called an installment agreement request, and you can use that form at any time. There is no time deadline by which you have to use that form.
Dan, we unfortunately have run out of time for this first part of the conversation. I'm excited about bringing you back for part two of the discussion. In closing, two questions. I've seen you appear on several faith-based broadcasts. what happens? Is there something that you are offering or that makes you sensitive to people of faith who are in business when it comes to these IRS dilemmas?
Well, just simply my own faith, Gail, which is, you know, I'm a Christian and have been for coming up on 30 years. And as a Christian, I got associated with a number of these Christian organizations that have broadcasts, particularly because I offer hope to people with problems. And Christianity is all about hope and forgiveness, and that's what this message is all about, hope and forgiveness.
Yeah. Yeah, those are two terms not often associated with the IRS.
Isn't that true?
Hope
and forgiveness.
That true? Dan Pilla, thank you so much for joining me. I know I had a second question, but I'm going to close with that one, and then I'll open up our next discussion with questions about, you know, your services, your fee structure, and then another important area for business owners is offshore.
Sure.
Jurisdiction and what that means, the limited liabilities, and then another question we'll come back and discuss in the next conversation is the role of the accountant when they're representing a client and they do something that's inappropriate. The IRS still comes back to the taxpayer, correct?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right. And we can talk about what to do about that. There are ways to deal with that as well.
We look forward to having you back again. Dan Pilla, taxhelponline.com is his website. I'm your host, Gail Sylvia, sylviaglobal.com. This broadcast will be available on iTunes podcast under sylviaglobal.com. Thank you so much for joining me, Dan.
My pleasure, Gail. Thanks for having me.